is for our Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump told the Financial Times if China is not going to solve the problem of North Korea, quote, we will. Mr. Trump said China has great influence over the North. China will either decide to help us or they won't. If they don't, it won't be good for anyone. His comments come ahead of the first summit with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Florida. Those comments were echoed by U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley on U.S. television Sunday.
China has to cooperate. This is now down to, do we want to continue to see these ballistic missile attacks from North Korea, or does China want to do something about it? And this is all about the fact that they need to have action. And we're going to continue to put pressure on China to have action. That will be shown in multiple ways. But what we are going to do is say, China, you know that you're the only one that's doing this. We appreciate that you stopped coal going into North Korea, but we know it's going in other ways. At some point, we need to see definitive actions by China condemning North Korea and not just calling them out for it.
Korea Economic Institute analyst Troy Stangerone said the Trump administration may be preparing secondary sanctions targeting Chinese firms doing business with North Korea.
What I would expect the Trump administration to do is to utilize those tools to go more directly after these types of entities to try and slow down North Korea's nuclear progress and also take and apply pressure on North Korea to bring it to the table.
Recent satellite images suggest the North may be preparing a sixth nuclear test. A national peace summit in Mali ended Sunday with a call on the government to negotiate with Islamist groups that have carried out attacks on Malian French and UN peacekeepers. The conference called on President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita to hold talks with Amadou Koufa of the Messina Liberation Front and Iyad Aghali, who heads the militant Ansar Dine. This is VOA News. In Ecuador's runoff presidential election, leftist candidate Lenin Moreno was slightly ahead of his conservative challenger, businessman Guillermo Lasso, in a surprisingly tight race to succeed Rafael Correa. Mark Jones is a regional analyst at Rice University.
Ecuador is a deeply polarized country. There are many people who strongly support the administration of President Rafael Correa, but then there also is a large segment of the population that believes that Correa has turned the country into a more authoritarian type of political system and also is too far to the left. So you really have a relatively divided and polarized country.
The outcome may determine the fate of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has been living in Ecuador's embassy in London. Since 2012, he's being sought by Sweden over rape allegations. Russian police arrested dozens of anti-corruption protesters in Moscow Sunday, who took to the streets a week after large-scale protests across the country. Nail Negamaktulin, coordinator of the Truckers Association of Russia in Sverdlovsk, he doesn't trust the ruling class. He said he wants them to leave and allow honest people to take over. Last week, more than 1,000 were detained during protests organized by Alexei Navalny, a leading critic of President Vladimir Putin. The U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley also insisted Sunday on U.S. television that the U.S. continues speaking out against Russia on policies like Syria and Ukraine. She was asked if she thought President Putin was a liar for insisting he did not try to influence last year's U.S. election.
You know, I've always said we don't trust Russia, and I think we're all aware that Russia was involved in the elections. And so I'm not going to talk about who's lying and who's not. I know that that's a very real thing. And so what we're doing from here going forward is we're going to be strong. We're going to be loud. We're going to make sure that when we can work with them, we can. But when they do something wrong, we're going to call them out and say it.
Haley said diplomat she speaks with welcomes a return of U.S. leadership on issues like Iran, Syria, Russia, and North Korea. President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is in Iraq accompanying the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford. Details on the trip were not immediately available, but Kushner, an advisor to Mr. Trump, has been offering advice on matters related to the Middle East, Canada, and Mexico. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu Sunday presided over the latest addition to Israel's missile defense. The medium-range interceptor is part of the David Sling system, developed in conjunction with the U.S., and fills the gap between longer-range Arrows and shorter-range Iron Dome interceptors. Pakistani police said 20 people were tortured and murdered at a Sufi shrine near Sargodha in Punjab province. The custodian of the shrine, described as mentally unstable, has been arrested and charged with the killings. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Democratic Republic of Congo braces for a nationwide protest today as Pope Francis calls for peace.
Our government is working for peace, and we do support this call from the Holy Father to help this country to live in peace.
Lamba Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir calls for the setting up of an African court as he criticizes the ICC as a colonial tool. Zimbabwe helps drought-stricken farmers grow more maize, and the former leader of South Africa's main opposition party has a Twitter problem.
Helen Zille is the former leader of the Democratic Alliance, and she's now got herself into trouble over some comments she's made on Twitter, where she said colonialism was not entirely negative, it had some positive benefits.
Daryl Glasser is the head of the Political Science Department at the University of Witwatersrand. And yesterday was the anniversary of the attack on Kenya's Garissa University. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley, sports, and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister says his government supports Pope Francis' call for peace in the DRC. This comes as the country braces for a nationwide stay-at-home protest today, Monday, which has been called by the main opposition coalition Rassemblement to force President Joseph Kabila to implement the December 31, 2016 agreement. Pope Francis on Sunday urged all Congolese to pray for peace and end all violence. Information Minister Lambert Mende blamed the violence and the delay in the peace process on what he calls a small group of people whose main goal is to get jobs for themselves. He accused unnamed foreign governments for interfering in the DRC by supporting a small segment of the opposition in an attempt to destroy the unity of the country.
This call from the Pope come after a call from all the churches that are here in Congo. They met, I think, 2 days ago and launched the same appeal for peace. And I know that even in the opposition, there are a lot of wise people who need to live in peace, that our problem be solved in peace. Only a small group of people who are after jobs, who are not disciplined enough to wait until we can find solution so that they can be appointed, because the many of them need to be minister, prime minister. You know that some others are even refusing to bury their own father because they are not being appointed prime minister. How stupid, how foolish this is.
But Minister, how can you say your government is for peace when President Kabila has not yet signed the December 31st agreement?
I have explained to you, James, that President Kabila is not concerned to sign an agreement, a political agreement, in the Constitution of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The President of the Republic is an institution, my dear. He is not a politician. He might be a politician, but as the head of state, he is not allowed to implicate himself in political agreements. So the president is not at all entitled to sign a political agreement, but his party can sign. But since he is a president, and until he will be the president, he can't sign a political agreement. Otherwise, he will violate the Constitution. I don't know in which language we should explain this to some people so that they understand.
Mr. Minister, on Monday, the opposition Rassemblement said they are going to turn the cities in your country into ghost towns because your president has refused to implement the agreement.
Those are members of a faction within the Rassemblement. They are divided. We know that they are supported by some backward forces from Western countries. We know well. And they are forging fake news about our country. But we know that many among those people within the Rassemblement of the opposition are really good citizens, and they are working for peace. So please, Don't tell to me that those people who say that they are going to make ghost town are the only one in the opposition. They are not even the majority in the opposition. So please, those are foolish people. I'm not even ready to discuss about them. It is a shame for our country.
Minister, the Pope makes reference to the clashes in the Kasai. What can you tell us about what's going on there?
We are not able to tell you as for now that who is doing what in Kasai. Probably the same people who need really to disturb the situation because they don't hold portfolios, they don't hold appointments. So we think that maybe those are people who have no interest of seeing Congo live in peace. And we start suspecting some people abroad, out of Africa, out of this continent. They are trying to destroy the unity of this country, to make what we call the Balkanization of Congo, because they feel Congo is so big, Congo is so rich. Let's make profit of this situation, of the delay of election, to destroy its unity.
Lamba Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir has called for the setting up of an African court to achieve justice in the continent rather than the International Criminal Court, which he describes as a colonial tool. President Bashir spoke Sunday in Khartoum to the first African conference of heads of justice and higher courts. The Sudanese president has been indicted twice by the ICC for alleged war crimes and genocide. Sudan's information minister, Ahmed Bilal, says President Bashir was simply repeating what most African countries want because they believe the ICC is a political and not a justice court.
In fact, Khartoum today witnessed a gathering of the higher courts from all Africa and the ministry presidents as well. And this is the first conference to be held in Khartoum. And he said this when he actually addressing this conference. And the idea, in fact, not new, but all the Africans now, they want to withdraw from the ICC and to make their own court here in Africa. And we are able actually to pursue whoever break the law or do some crimes or something like that instead of this ICC, which is, for us proved to be a political court and not a judiciary court.
You said the president also said that the ICC has been politicized. But who is politicizing the ICC when the argument is that it is Africans themselves who have taken their own fellow Africans to the ICC.
In fact, some countries, when they sign the Roma, when they want to go to make the ICC, they didn't put in their actually their mind that this court will tend to be a court which actually subjecting only the Africans and which have allegations which are almost all are politicized. And nobody from the other world is being pursued by this court. And exemption for others like the Israelis, like the Americans from the court and so forth. Now it is established in Africa, this court is not a fair court. So we want actually to prove to the world that we are also want fair justice. And that is why we are calling for a court, an African court to be instituted.
Mr. Minister, as you know, your president, two arrest warrants have been issued from the ICC for war crimes. Is President Bashir asking for the establishment of an African court because he does not believe that he should go to the ICC to defend himself?
We don't actually recognize this court. Why should he go for that? And actually, we succeed to convince others to withdraw from this court and not to recognize it. And this is actually, we think this is some sort of a new colonization, which only directed toward those who have their own resolutions and they don't want to be the new colonizers. For us, this is a problem of self-dependence. And we are actually calling all the Africans for a new era of freedom and liberation from the new colonizers. For us, the ICC is a symbol of that. Now, from this gathering, it is clear that the whole Africa is with us in this idea. So what's your problem? We have our own court. Why the court of the white man?
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Today is Monday, April 13. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The Zimbabwe government is helping drought-stricken farmers grow more maize to ensure food self-sufficiency. Sebastian Mofu reports.
In Zimbabwe, a tractor loaded with tobacco arrives at an auction floor in Harare, driven by farmers from Urungwe area, about 300 kilometers north of the capital. One of them is Felix Taruchira.
I prefer tobacco because when we compare my prices, maize prices are lower than tobacco. So farmers, as they want money quickly, they tend to grow tobacco than maize.
But maize remains the country's staple crop. And in an effort to recover from drought-induced food shortages, the government is encouraging farmers to grow more of it. One strategy has been pegging the buying price of maize at $390 per ton, among the highest prices in the world. But the government rarely pays farmers in a timely manner, said Paul Zakaria, the executive director of Zimbabwe Farmers Union.
By default, many farmers will be producing maize. But if you put maize and maize does not pay, where you could have put tobacco, and tobacco would have given you three times, four times over what maize is giving you. So you go for that which gives you money. Then out of the proceeds of that high-value crop, you can buy your grain, feed your family.
And Zakaria points out Zimbabwe could use the profit from tobacco and other cash crops to import maize that is more affordable.
Or even as a nation, we could put high-value crops in our fields, make the money that you require, import the grain, and it lands in our country much, much cheaper than the $390 that we buy it locally.
However, that approach can leave the country vulnerable in times of crisis. The El Nino-induced drought in 2015 and 2016 left Zimbabwe struggling with serious food shortages. The government could not afford to import grain on short notice and ended up relying on aid agencies. An estimated 4 million Zimbabweans currently rely on food handouts from international organizations until this year's harvest that starts in April. That is according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Ahead of the 2016-2017 planting season, the government launched what it called Targeted Command Agriculture Policy. The goal is ensuring food self-sufficiency. The government gave participating farmers maize seeds and supplies. In return, the farmers will give the government 5 tons of maize per hectare at harvest time. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The former leader of South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance Party is facing disciplinary action for tweeting that colonialism was not all negative and that it had some positive attributes. Ellen Zille, who is currently the governor of the Western Cape province, could be expelled if found guilty. In her tweet, she cited South Africa's independent judiciary, transport infrastructure, and piped water. Daryl Glaser is the head of the Political Science Department at the University of Witwatersrand.
Helen Zille is the former leader of the Democratic Alliance, and she's now got herself into trouble over some comments she's made on Twitter about colonialism, where she said colonialism was not entirely negative. It had some positive benefits, which is a very politically problematic and insensitive thing to say in a South African context. And the new black leader is having to assert his authority, Musi Maimane, by showing that he's not going to simply accommodate Helen Zille, even though she was regarded as one of the very powerful figures in the DA and a very successful political operator. And she's currently the governor or the premier of the Western Cape province, Muzi Maimane, the DA leader, feels he has to stamp his authority to demonstrate that the DA is no longer a white party, that its new black leadership has genuine authority. And so this very significant South African political figure faces internal party disciplinary proceedings.
To what extent could this be damaging to the Democratic Alliance?
Well, it could potentially be damaging to the Democratic Alliance, which is why the DA leader feels the need to act against her in the way that he is acting. The DA has been very successful in winning the support of not only whites, but other racial minorities like the so-called Cape Coloured mixed-race population and the Indians. But their real challenge is to win support in the black African majority. And Helen Zille actually initially was very committed to that project and made some strides in that direction in terms of winning the black vote. But she also has this tendency to get into battles with people on Twitter. And the DA has made only limited progress in winning the black African vote, and this potentially could reverse that progress. The danger for the DA, of course, is that Helen Zille is still very popular with whites and probably some other racial minorities who make up the bulk of the DA support base. So the DA leader has to assert his authority, but also be careful not to lose the party's historical base.
It seems that the African National Congress is already capitalizing on this tweet by Ms. Helen Zille by saying here that for the Democratic Alliance black members, uncertainty remains on where the party stands on racism, suggesting that Maimane is having difficulty separating himself from Helen Zille, who they are suggesting single-handedly picked him to lead the party.
Yes, I mean, Maimane has to demonstrate his independence. You know, you get parties like the African National Congress and the Economic Freedom Fighters who mock black leaders in the DA, not only Maimane, but some others before him, for being puppets of white power holders in the DA. And it's absolutely essential that Maimane demonstrate to the potential black supporters of the DA that he's his own man, and that he's not just a token figurehead leader of the DA, but a genuine leader and a force to be reckoned with.
Daryl Glisser is the head of the Political Science Department at the University of Witwatersrand. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg. 2 years ago yesterday, Al-Shabaab fighters carried out a deadly attack on Garissa University College, the only higher education institution in the entire northeastern Kenya, killing 148 people, almost all of them students. Since then, the university has made significant progress in maintaining a tight security and enrolling 585 new students, which is still short of the 800 who were attending the college at the time of the attack. Akme Osman Wafa is the Garissa University principal.
The situation has so far improved. We opened the university last year, January, and we were able to admit 585 students. Life has gone on. We have picked the pieces and we're moving on. We've also established a police station. We are now building a perimeter wall around the university. Once it's completed, we're going to have TV cameras. We're also going to have watchtowers. And we're also going to have floodlights that are able to help us secure the place at night. The other thing is we are able to acquire biometric equipment at the gate where students are identified through their fingerprints. That has helped us a lot to make sure that we keep out non-students from the university.
Okay, so tell me exactly how you recruited this new crop of students.
One, we did marketing. We had to use local FM stations, we had to use the newspapers. And two, some of them were recruited from the main pool. All university students are going to one pool. There's a central placement where students are taken from and given to universities. So we were given about 470 from that pool, but out of 470, only 100 reported because they thought that the university was not safe, and for some other reasons, others went to transfer to other institutes.
And what are the challenges in front of you in terms of helping the students learn, in terms
We have a lot of challenges. One, we still have that stigma that Garissa University is not safe because of what happened, because of the students who lost their life in the university. The other stigma is that we happen to be in a remote area because it's the only university in the whole of northern Kenya. And the people think that university is not equipped enough. That's also another problem. The third problem is right now, most students who are attending university reside outside. We have about three halls that are empty. So there's only one hall that's occupied by the students. So this is a problem also for us.
There has also been concerns about recruitment within universities. What's your take on that?
Of course, yes, there's a radicalization that's going on within the universities. But we have been able to talk to the students through their local leaders, through their local NGOs that deal with issues of radicalization, also through the local religious elders. We're able to preach to them on Fridays and Sunday evenings to talk to them on issues of radicalization, issues of religious fanaticism, and things to do with terrorism. So through that, we're able to help students at least engage in activities that are useful. Another thing also that we do is constant roll calls to make sure that all students attend classes. And we always check all the students who do not attend class or miss exams or are in the school but are not going to any class. And for one reason or the other, are doing other things. So the students we target and find out why and what is happening. So this has helped us really improve our situation. And this has also stopped radicalization in the institution.
Ahmed Osman Wafa is the principal of Garissa University College. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of the Somali Service. Time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with boxing news from Nigeria, where the Nigerian Boxing Board of Control has rejected the outcome of the World Boxing Association super middleweight title fight between champion Tyron Zuige of Germany and Nigeria's Isaac Egbo. The fight, which took place at the MBS Potsdam Brandenburg in Germany, March 25, saw the German coming out tops. But the MBB of C scribe Remy Abodirin disagrees with the decision of the referee Raul Kiaz and the judges. Abodirin is, however, consoled by reports that Ekpo's camp are planning to challenge the champion again for a rematch. He said the MBB of C were solidly behind Ekpo on these and will lodge their official protest with the president of the World Boxing Association on the daylight boxing robbery. And to Kenya, where Kenyan's Jocelyn Jepkosgei broke four world records at the Sportsimo Prague Half Marathon, where she won the IWAF Gold Label Road Race in 1 hour 4 minutes 52 seconds on Saturday. The 23-year-old competing in just her fifth half marathon to date also smashed world records for 10 kilometers, 15 kilometers and 20 kilometers en route to her victory. To South Africa now, where defending champion Ben Hoffman retained his title, winning the 2017 edition of the Ironman African Championships in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. Hoffman also made history by breaking the course record, finishing in a time of 7 hours and 57 minutes. In the female category, world champion Daniela Ryf of Switzerland dominated the women's race. Ryf, a double global champion, lived up to the hype as a pre-race favorite by charging to a convincing win in the women's race in 8 hours, 47 minutes, 1 seconds. The 13th African Championships attracted professional cyclists from all over the world, with 69 nations competing in the 2017 Championships. The African Championships serve as qualifiers for the World Championships taking place in Hawaii later in 2017. In football news, Uganda Cranes striker Captain Geoffrey Massa has retired from national team duties, the Ugandan Cranes, to focus on professional football, though he currently doesn't have a club to play for after being cut off by South African struggling side Baroka United FC. Massa, who played for the Ugandan national team for 12 years, made a total of 89 appearances for the Cranes. And to Ghana, where the president of the Ghana Football Association, Kwesi Nyantakyi, has assured Ghanaians that the country's national football team, the Black Stars, will have a new coach soon enough after concluding interviews for the shortlisted candidates at the weekend. Hugo Bros, Willy Sagnol and Ghanaian Kwesi Appiah are the leading candidates for the job. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports for this Monday morning. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, April 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a productive week.